Lisboa,
Bruxelles,
Sofia,
Warszawa.
This podcast has been produced in cooperation with Euronet Plus, the leading radio network for EU news.
But this podcast would not be possible without the incredibly generous support of our amazing listeners who donate a little bit each month at patreon.com/Europeans Podcast.
Welcome back to the Europeans. This is Katie in Paris, and this is your weekly European tasting menu. Some of it tastes sweet, some of it tastes like corruption, but all of it will taste relatively fresh, like well within the sell-by date at least.
Katie's back, and so are the food analogies.
Haha, Dominic's back, and he's a really heavy breather this week, listeners. I hope you're not put off by all of the...
I've got a cold.
Oh, I'm sorry. Rough.
Sorry.
How bad is it? It sounds like I'm going to catch it over here via the internet.
You might. I hope you've had your flu jab. And I hope you're doing better over there than I am over here. How is life in Paris?
I'm all right, yeah. I've been mostly watching the latest goings-on in the European Parliament with a kind of grim fascination this week. The centre-right joining forces with the far-right to dismantle European climate regulation as requested by Donald Trump. We're not going to talk about that very much this week because we talk about the far right many weeks and we've got some other stuff that we want to talk about this week. But I'll link to a good post about it in the show notes in case you want to read up on all of that because it is important.
Yeah, it's like not the sexiest thing to talk about, the far right firewall going up in smoke in the European Parliament, but it does seem quite significant. I saw our friend Alberto Alemano describing it as a somber day for Europe. So we definitely should come back to it later and keep an eye on what it means, whether this is the beginning of a big shift there. I hope not.
But what are we talking about this week?
Well, later on, we're going to be talking about some very happy artists living in Ireland because the basic income experiment they've been trialling there is being made permanent.
Woohoo!
Katie will be calling up Professor John Baker later on in the show to hear about this Irish scheme and to chat more broadly about basic incomes. I feel like we talked about them quite a bit on the show many years ago, but we kind of forgot about them for a bit. So I'm glad Ireland is making us talk about it again. That's coming up later on in the show, but first, it's time for Good Week, Bad Week.
Good Week, Bad Week.
Let's start with Bad Week. Who's had a bad week, Katie?
Sorry, I'm so distracted. Your voice is so deep this week. I like it.
It's not a good week to be an opera singer.
Bad week for Dominic. Otherwise, though, I'm going to give bad week to Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, who is battling probably the worst scandal that he's faced since he became president 6 years ago. It is a massive corruption scandal. Have you read much about this?
No, to be honest, it's one of those stories that I just feel like I can't face learning about it now, something that seems bleak in an already very complicated situation. So, yeah, I guess I'm kind of pleased that you're going to force me to learn about it.
I'm going to force you to learn about this bleak story. Well, there's some slightly less bleak elements to it, but it's like 80% bleak, I'd say. Anyway, let's get into it. It is pretty jaw-dropping. The bombshell accusation that has been put forward by Ukraine's anti-corruption agency is that Ukraine's nuclear energy operator, which is a company called Energoatom, it got taken over by a kind of mafia, essentially. It turns out that people with very good government connections were kind of standing between the nuclear power operator and the companies that it was doing business with. And they would say, yeah, you're going to need to add another 10 or 15% to the value of that contract, which you are going to pay to us. Otherwise, we're going to keep standing in the way and this contract won't get signed or your invoice won't get paid. Like, it is quite literally mobster behavior, you know? Like, it is a racket. These were gangsters wearing suits. And in total, it's thought that about $100 million were stolen in this way.
Whoa. Mm. So you said it's people with good government connections who were involved in this, mm-hmm. but presumably not Zelensky himself, I take it?
Yeah, no, not Zelensky himself. The people who've been charged over this include the former Deputy Prime Minister, Alexei Chernyshov. He's accused of personally making about $1.5 million through this scheme.
Whoa.
They also include a former advisor to the energy minister, a former department chief at this nuclear company. One of the names, though, is particularly awkward for Zelensky, and that is the alleged ringleader of all of this. He's a guy called Timur Mindich, and he is the co-owner of the TV production company that Zelensky founded before he was president. The company is called Kvartal 95. It's the company that made Servant of the People, you know, that comedy that Zelensky actually starred in his mm-hmm. former life as an actor, which feels like an entirely different universe. But yeah, it would be a mistake to see this business associate of Zelensky's, Timur Mindich, as being a mere TV executive. Mindich had a lot of political influence, a lot of fingers and a lot of different pies. And yeah, Ukraine's anti-corruption agency named this guy, this former friend of Zelensky, as being the brains behind this lucrative little scheme. Mindich was supposed to be arrested last week, but he managed to slip out of the country before they could do that.
Wow.
He took a taxi to Poland, apparently, and he is now believed to be hiding somewhere in Israel. But before he disappeared, he was secretly recorded by the anti-corruption agency, apparently planning who was going to get how much money and generally doing like high-level scheming to keep this racket in operation. There's quite a lot of other evidence that's been made public by the corruption investigators, including pictures of bags of cash and pictures of extremely fancy flats in Kyiv that have been raided. One of these flats actually had a gold toilet. I'm not joking,
no.
A gold toilet. Also, not just the toilet, like the toilet brush next to it was also gold. Fun, huh?
The gold toilet element just feels kind of too much. It feels like it's something out of a movie.
It is. It's like proper Bond villain behavior.
Yeah, I bet that detail is going down really well with the public.
You know, the whole thing is going down horribly with the public. I think it says a lot that in a country that is at war, this is generating such visceral anger. You know, Ukrainians have put up with so much over the past 4 years. And in many cases, they've refrained from criticizing the leadership because it's just been felt that, you know, we need to all pull together. We need to beat Russia and we need to let our leaders get on with it. Even elections are being put aside for now. But this is people close to the leadership, some people with gold toilets, apparently, stealing obscene amounts of money to spend it on houses and cars, whatever they like. At a time when Ukrainians are still dying in Russian strikes and they are still dying at the front. And by the way, they are also still funding the war with their own money a lot of the time. A lot of people are still donating whatever they can each month to help the war effort. And it's particularly galling that this scandal involved these people interfering in the work of a state energy company, because ordinary Ukrainians are already having to deal with rolling blackouts every day, and it looks like they are heading into the most difficult winter of the war so far. You know, maybe not just the electricity going off all the time, but also the heating, maybe even the water. Russia has been really laser-focused on attacking Ukraine's energy infrastructure lately. And some of the contracts that these corrupt officials were skimming money off of, they were literally projects aimed at protecting nuclear power stations from Russian missile attacks, which just shows, you know, how willing these people were to let personal greed get in the way of defending the country.
Mm. And so what's being done about this scandal? I mean, presumably the government has to react and do something.
Yeah, they are reacting. They are doing some stuff. So Zelensky has announced a big change of leadership in the state energy companies, a complete change of management at Energoatom, the nuclear operator at the heart of all of this. He fired the justice minister and the energy minister. They both say they've done nothing wrong, but they were both protégés of Mindich, the alleged ringleader. So Zelensky has been doing some stuff. And just to stress, once again, he hasn't been personally implicated in the scandal. However, he has been widely accused of moving very, very slowly in trying to fix this. And some people are asking whether that might be because it involved people close to him, Like, it really doesn't look great for Zelensky. And it especially doesn't look great because you might remember over last summer, there were these big, big protests in Ukraine after Zelensky basically tried to dismantle the very anti-corruption agency that has now uncovered this scandal. There were these huge protests in Kyiv, in Odessa, in Lviv, all because it looked like Zelensky was trying to make it easier to be corrupt. And with retrospect, it looks pretty dodgy that he was trying to shut this agency and another one down just as the investigators were closing in on the scandal. Like, the timing is kind of interesting. Mm. None of it is a great look, and it is especially not a great look at a time when Ukraine is applying for EU membership. And fighting corruption, having strong institutions, that's obviously a big part of the application process. You are simply not going to be granted EU membership if your country is seen as a place where corruption is really easy and really widespread.
Yeah, and on the other hand, the scandal was eventually able to come out. It wasn't kept out of the public eye. And that does suggest to some extent that Ukraine is getting better at fighting corruption, no?
Yeah, and funnily enough, that is exactly the spin that Zelensky's allies are trying to put on things. Like, well, if you look at it this way. But it is a good point. Like, even NABU, which is the anti-corruption agency that revealed all of this, after Zelensky tried to kill the agency off, their own officials have said, you know, this scandal would not have come out in Russia. It probably wouldn't have even come out in Hungary. And it certainly wouldn't have come out in such a splashy way. I mean, hats off to the anti-corruption agency for the media campaign they've been running around this, because they've been like drip feeding the revelations online in quite a gripping way. Like, they've got these slick videos of their investigators on YouTube explaining everything with all the audio from these wiretaps. So it is something to be celebrated that they have been able to do this and allowed to do all of this. But Zelensky has a lot of making up to do to the Ukrainian people, especially, you know, as someone who came into politics in the first place, promising to tackle corruption. That is how he became president. His ratings have been dropping. Many Ukrainians, of course, have been willing to put up with no elections, cut him a lot of slack. There aren't that many people who could have led Ukraine through everything that has happened in the past 3 years. And Zelensky has been courageous at many points. He's been charismatic. At the same time, he is, like every politician, very deeply imperfect. And a lot of Ukrainians apparently see him as increasingly operating within this tiny circle that see themselves as beyond the rules and having this idea that the war gives them license to do effectively whatever they want. I think the reaction to this corruption scandal and the protests in the summer when Zelensky was trying to shut the investigators down, they show that he's not untouchable. Even though there are no elections, he does have to listen. And I guess you could see that as a good thing. So I'm going to give this to Zelensky for a horrible week in politics, but there is maybe a little tiny silver lining in it.
Yeah, okay, that was 80% bleak.
Did I get the ratio correct?
Yeah, good expectation management.
There's the silver lining and the gold toilet. Let's not forget the gold toilet. Who's had a good week, Dominic?
Well, this is the section of the show that is coming to you in cooperation with our radio partners at Euronet Plus. And it's been maybe a good week for pedestrians in Slovakia after the government introduced an amendment to the Road Traffic Act, putting a speed limit on how fast bicycles, scooters, skateboards, and other wheeled items can ride on the pavement.
Okay. I mean, I guess that sounds like it could be potentially good news. It's nice not to be knocked over by skateboarders. What is the speed limit? Like, how fast can I go on my skateboard now?
Well, honestly, I have to fess up already. This is another case of me picking a topic which I thought was going to be a good week, but after digging into it and reading about it for a day, I've discovered that it really isn't a good week at all. I'm sorry. Because in answering your question, what is the speed limit? The amendment already gets a bit silly. The speed limit is 6 kilometers per hour, or 3.7 miles per hour for our listeners who are of the miles persuasion. And the reason why I'm saying that's silly is because, as has been pointed out by many critics of this law, 6 kilometers per hour is a really challengingly slow speed to cycle at.
Is it? I was going to say, like, I have no idea. Do I cycle at more than 6 kilometers an hour?
You absolutely do.
Okay.
It's actually quite hard work to keep your balance while cycling that slowly. It's also been pointed out by the Slovak cycling advocacy group Cycling Coalition that kids, who are maybe the group who cycle the most on the pavement for their own safety, are very likely to exceed that speed limit, even your little three-year-old child. And surely the idea isn't to move three-year-old children who are learning to cycle onto the road. The reality of this legislation seems to be the criminalization of an activity that is pretty normal, kids riding on sidewalks.
I'm sorry, I just got this mental image of like someone trying to force their toddler to cycle at 3 kilometers an hour and then just toppling over because it's so hard. This is so stupid.
I guess if you have stabilizers, it's a bit easier to cycle slowly, potentially. But yeah, the current Slovak road legislation says that it's legal for a child under 10 to ride on the pavement and also for an accompanying adult to cycle on the pavement, so long as they're not endangering pedestrians. And I mean, that seems like a perfectly reasonable thing to have in law. But adding in this 6 kilometer per hour limit is just going to make it so much more challenging for that to be possible. One of the other critiques from the Cycling Coalition, which I have to say I found quite convincing, is that with this new amendment, kids will either be forced to travel more in cars or they'll continue cycling above 6 kilometers per hour and will just learn from a young age that regulations are there to be ignored, which is also not what we want.
Yeah, it's gone quite quickly from public safety to like, let's teach six-year-olds that the law doesn't matter. Okay, yeah, this is indeed sounding sillier than I also first thought. Great good week choice.
Thank you.
Why did they choose 6 kilometers per hour anyway? Like, is that just a random number that they plucked from nowhere? Or is there some kind of logic behind it?
They went with that speed because it's roughly the upper limit of how fast people walk normally. How fast you walk, of course, depends very much on your age and other factors, but people generally walk somewhere between 4 and 5.9 kilometers per hour. You're quite a slow walker, Katie.
That's rude. Very rude. You've got crazy long legs. I can't keep up with you.
Katie always complains when we're together with Wojciech and Katz that we all walk too fast.
It's because you're all giants.
Anyway, so you might be on the lower end of that scale, to be honest, but... But still, no shade. 6 kilometers per hour is still very slow for cycling. Anyway, this law has sparked a lot of memes in Slovakia and also quite a bit of misleading international press coverage after it was wrongly interpreted that this speed limit on the pavements also applied to humans walking. Yeah, I was actually surprised how many international outlets reported that wrongly. It would have been much more fun if that was the case, but sadly it's not true. And I mean, it's worth mentioning that Slovakia's populist Robert Fico-led government have had some wacky policies, but thankfully they haven't gone quite that insane with this amendment that they're actually applying a speed limit to walking on the sidewalk. You're still allowed to run for the bus or go for a speed walk if you want to. But yeah, they chose this speed limit because I guess the idea is that the wheeled objects should be traveling at a pace that's similar to walking speed. And the government think that they will limit accidents happening on the pavement.
I can't believe I'm asking this, but are there lots of collisions on pavements in Slovakia? Like, is this a bigger problem in Slovakia than elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And it's very difficult to know because actually the Slovak police don't separate accidents that take place on the pavement from the road in their records. What I could find was a statement from a politician from the opposition movement PS who told the conservative daily newspaper Postoj that last year the police recorded only 3 accidents between scooters and pedestrians. 3.
Nationwide?
Yeah. But I haven't found the data for cyclists or skateboarders or other forms of transport that are affected by this data. But if we stick with e-scooters for a minute, there definitely is something to be said for governments wanting to regulate how e-scooters are used in combination with pedestrians. E-scooters are seen by some, even from this cycling coalition, as a form of transport that actually could do with some regulation. I have to say, I find them a bit scary and dangerous when I come across one on a pavement in a foreign city. But apparently, even as a measure for controlling e-scooters, this amendment is not necessary.
Oh.
because it's going to be entirely irrelevant some weeks after the amendment comes into force, because there's a separate amendment coming that's also been passed that makes it illegal for e-scooters to ride on pavements at all.
All right, so they wouldn't be there 6 kilometres on those 6 kilometres.
Yeah, indeed. Then just not going to be on pavements.
So is this amendment doing anything at all?
Yeah, I mean, arguably not much, right, other than potentially getting some kids under 10 and their parents into trouble. And honestly, it's currently not clear how this law would even be enforced once it comes into force in January. I saw some reporting suggesting that police don't even have speedometers that can like tell the difference at such low speeds between whether or not it's 6 or 8 kilometers per hour.
And how are you as the actual skateboarder supposed to know that? Like, skateboards don't come with speedometers either.
Well, exactly. I mean, the idea is that pavement users could be fined up to 100 euros for exceeding the speed limits, but we'll have to wait and see if it actually gets policed at all. The critics say that all this law is going to do is maybe push a few more people into using cars, and that there needs instead to be more investment in cycling infrastructure in Slovakia instead of more policing of cyclists and scooter users.
That's a good point, actually. Like, if the roads were safer, more people would feel like they could be okay on the roads. And
yeah,
maybe they're targeting the wrong people here. I'm curious on that note. Like, what is the cycling infrastructure in Slovakia like? Is it relatively good these days?
Well, things are slowly improving, largely thanks to funding from the EU's Recovery and Resilience Plan. There have been many more cycle lanes appearing in recent years, but there's also frustration from cyclists that things are not moving faster than they could do. Oh, sorry, that was no pun intended about speed limits. For example, if we look at Bratislava, there the mayor had promised to build 70 kilometres of new separated cycle lanes by the end of his term in 2026. That goal will now not be possible. Mm. I read a report in Smer, Bratislava, saying that only 4 kilometres of new cycle lanes were made last year. And of those 4 kilometres, only 645 metres were separated cycle lanes. So, yeah, that goal seems quite far off, that 70-kilometre goal.
Yeah, it does. And in terms of like how this ridiculous rule compares to like what happens elsewhere in Europe, is Slovakia kind of alone in regulating like what bikes and scooters, like how fast they can go on the pavements? Or are there actually quite a few countries doing this and I just haven't heard about them?
Well, a lot of other European countries have bans or partial bans for cycling on pavements, and especially recently for e-scooters on pavements. Speed limits are not as common, maybe because it's so difficult to enforce and because people often don't know what speed they're riding at unless, yeah, they've got a speedometer on their skateboard. There is a newish rule in Hungary that cyclists on pavements or in pedestrian zones have to cycle under 10 kilometres per hour. This seems slightly more realistic than the wobbly making 6 kilometres per hour. Barcelona has a speed limit of up to 10 kilometres per hour for personal mobility vehicles on the pavement. So that's e-scooters, e-skateboards, hoverboards, all those kind of things.
Oh, yeah. What happened to hoverboards? Those have kind of died a death, haven't they? You still see them very occasionally here in Paris.
I actually saw someone using one round the corner from my house a few days ago, and luckily he was wearing a helmet because he did not know how to use it and kept falling over. In Italy, there is also a 6 kilometre per hour speed limit on pavements, but only for e-scooters, not for bikes. Mm-hmm. So that kind of makes a bit more sense. So yeah, there are lots of different ways to design your rules around these vehicles on pavements, but it's probably not the good week I promised for pedestrians on pavements in Slovakia. I mean, maybe some bicycle-hating pedestrians are happy about this new rule coming in. That's very possible. But yeah, it's, sorry.
I actually feel like I'll be less safe on the streets of Slovakia as a result of this, because I'm going to get hit by like a toppling toddler falling off their bike.
Exactly, yeah. The danger is now sideways. And before I move on, a big thanks to listener Arnold, who helped me out with some local context for this piece. I really love that we are more and more involving our listeners in the making of this show. And yeah, I thought I might repeat something that was said many months ago on this show, that we are collecting lists of listeners who are experts in certain fields or certain regional areas, so that we can call on you for potential fact checking or extra context Email us at hello@europeanspodcast.com with the country, region or topic areas you'd be happy to help out with, and we'll add you to the list. Thank you so much in advance.
Thank you, experts. I realised something the other day.
What?
We are coming up to the end of the year, and it is the first year in the history of the Europeans that we haven't had to think, oh God, are we even going to be able to make the podcast next year? Like, we know that we're going to be able to make the podcast next year. Mm-hmm. How amazing is that?
It's so amazing.
And the reason that we're able to do this is that we're part of this consortium of radio stations, Euronet Plus, and that has given us a little bit of financial stability up until the end of 2026. However, we still have no idea what's going to happen after that. So our goal is to get ourselves to a place where it is literally just listener donations every week that are covering all of our running costs. Can you help us do that? Even really small recurring donations can help us get there if enough people do it. So if you enjoy the show and you want to help us keep being able to make it into the future, we would love it if you could sign up to send a little bit of money our way at patreon.com/Europeans Podcast.
Yes, any spare cash is very much appreciated. I would like to give a shout out to our latest supporters. They are Brendan, Brad, Themis, Rachel, and Lars. Thank you all so much. If you can't afford to support us financially at the moment, another way you can help us out is by giving us a shout out on social media or, I don't know, in your favorite Signal or WhatsApp group. Anything that helps us grow also helps find us potential future Patreon supporters. Do I sound too grabby?
anything at all. It's your sickness, Dominic. It's making you desperate.
It is. I'm needy again. Anyway, thank you all so much for supporting our podcast.
Please give us €2 so Dominic can go make himself a cup of soup or something. A rather interesting policy announcement caught our eye last month. For the last 3 years, Ireland has been running a pilot program in which they've been experimenting with giving cash to artists to cover their basic living expenses, regardless of how much they work. €325 a week, to be precise, so €1,300 a month. 2,000 people who work in the creative sector took part in this experiment. So not just visual artists, but also dancers, musicians, writers, filmmakers. And it was quite exciting that Ireland decided to experiment with this in the first place. But it's even more exciting that they've actually decided to keep doing this. Why are they going to keep doing this? Why are they going to keep paying artists just to exist? It's because they've decided that on balance, they actually got a lot of bang for their buck out of this scheme. Instead of making these lazy artists slack off because they just had some money to live off of, they actually worked more once they got the money. They also claimed less in welfare benefits. And society benefited too from having access to more of this creative work. Now, you are a tortured artist yourself, Dominic. You work as a singer when you're not here podcasting. So this is maybe a cruel question, but like, how would having the stability of that €1,300 a month, no questions asked, how do you think that would change the way that you live and the way that your colleagues live?
Well, I feel a bit like a fraud answering that question because I'm actually one of the very few lucky ones who has a fixed position at an opera house, mm-hmm. at least part-time. So I'm okay, but yeah, I have so many friends I studied with in various different fields in theatre and music and opera who have already had to give up in their mid-30s because they just couldn't afford the financial instability of it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, lots of people I know also just juggle many, many different jobs, like working in a bar, then doing some dancing jobs. And it would be so amazing for these people if they could just focus on their art making.
Yeah.
And they would make better art.
Yeah, and that is what so many participants in this Irish experiment have said, that they have made better art and just been better at their jobs as a result of having this little bit of stability in their lives. It should be noted that even though Ireland is carrying on with the scheme, it is still relatively modest in scale. For now, you're still going to have to apply for a spot on it. It isn't going to be open to just all artists in Ireland. It's still going to just be for around 2,000 people.
Oh,
Oh, indeed. I mean, it's still a win, though, right?
Yeah, I guess it's something, but it's not as widespread as I thought it was going to be.
We'll take the wins that we can. But there are a lot of valid questions to be asked. Is this system open to abuse? Are there downsides? Why give this money to artists and not to the many other people who do precarious work? I thought it would be good to speak to someone who has thought a lot about the whole idea of providing this kind of basic income to all kinds of people. John Baker, he's a founding member of the Equality Studies Centre at University College Dublin and one of the coordinators behind the Basic Income Ireland campaign. I gave him a call in Dublin. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm very glad to be here.
To people who haven't really thought that much before about how this kind of scheme could work, it might not feel intuitive that if you give people, you know, 300, 325 euros a week, they'll actually end up working more and relying less on welfare. You'd think people would just work less and be lazier. Why does it work?
Well, basically, a basic income gives you a platform from which to live your life the way you want to. And most people in general want to make a contribution to society and want to do something useful. In the case of artists, they have a passion, they have a vocation. So what the basic income for the arts project showed was that on average, the artists were spending a lot more time doing their artistic work and a lot less time doing other stuff that they had been forced to do in order to put bread on the table.
Mm. Does it always work like this, though? I mean, I saw a basic income experiment in the US where the participants who did get some money did indeed work less. Why do you think it works for the Irish artists, but it didn't in this specific US case?
Well, actually, the results of the two pilots aren't that different. I mean, in the American case, which was about 1,000 participants in two locations in the United States, they showed that they worked maybe an hour or two less in their paid work and that they devoted the bulk of that extra time to leisure. And in fact, in the Irish case, they also showed that the recipients of the basic income for the arts had an hour or so more leisure in their lives than the control group. So there isn't that much of a difference. And I guess part of the issue is that if you're a low-paid person with a irregular job that might have to be working very long hours, then if you get a bit of a hand up by getting a basic income, you might well decide to cut back on your hours. That's not such a bad thing.
Right, yeah. Are you saying it's kind of fundamentally wrong to see it as automatically a bad thing if people who get this money do indeed work less?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Why did Ireland decide to experiment with basic income in the culture sector? Like, is there a reason why we might need this kind of scheme for people that work in the arts more than other industries?
Well, I'm a proponent for universal basic income, so I wouldn't say that the culture industry is a privileged sector. But what I would say is that the people who work in the arts in Ireland anyway, and I think that's probably true more globally, do have very precarious lives and economically. Their work is intermittent. It's often low paid. Sometimes they're expected to work for free. They're told that they'll give them exposure, but exposure doesn't put any meals on the table. So they're a good case from the point of view of the general idea of universal basic income because of their precarious economic situation.
But the way it works with this artist scheme is that Irish artists and creative people getting this money will get the money even if they start doing really, really well, even if they become like the next, you know, like Irish Beyonce or CMAT, I guess we could say. What is the argument for continuing to give this money to artists who don't actually need the cash to make ends meet each month?
Well, again, that's a question that is asked about universal basic income as well. And what we in the basic income movement have always said is that there's a strong case for a universal payment. But if you want to target that payment, you do it by means of the tax system rather than by means of means testing. So in all universal basic income schemes. You introduce basic income, but you also change the tax regime so that people who are at the upper end of the income scale are paying more in extra tax than they're getting in basic income. Now, in a pilot project, whether it's the BIA or whether it's any of the other pilot projects that we've seen around the world, it's very hard to simulate that taxation part. Mm. But you could do that in principle, even in the basic income for the arts scheme, by introducing some kind of surtax on high incomes for artists who are doing very well.
I wanted to ask how you feel about how, you know, the kind of vibe has shifted on like the conversation around universal basic income. Because I feel like 4 or 5 years ago, there was quite a lot of buzz around the idea, lots and lots of pilot schemes for people who do all kinds of work, including unpaid work, like care work or voluntary work. But yeah, most of the pilot schemes that have been done around universal basic income in various countries around the world, they've been discontinued. Why do you think that is? And do you still feel hopeful that Ireland will indeed one day bring in a version of the scheme that is for everyone, regardless of what they do in life?
Well, I'm not sure that it's true that the pilot schemes have been discontinued. I mean, there's quite a lot still going on. A lot of pilot projects in the United States, for instance. There are big pilot projects that are going on in Africa at the moment. Mm-hmm. Of course, I think one of the reasons why basic income had a kind of peak a few years ago was in response to COVID, because everyone could see that if we had had a basic income system in place when COVID hit and people lost their jobs, then there would be immediate income support for people in a way that had to be kind of invented by various states, including Ireland. I think that this is the direction that social welfare should be moving in, and not just in Ireland, but globally. I'm not sure that Ireland will be the leader on this in terms of universal basic income, but I think that this is a hopeful move, that it's introducing this kind of support for one group of disadvantaged workers. There are a lot of misconceptions about what Ireland is doing here. What we've had is a pilot that gave 2,000 people 325 euros a week for 3 years. They're going to get their last payment in February, and then those 2,000 people will no longer have any support. It's a bit like if you were a drug company and you were running a randomized control trial on a drug that was supposed to deal with some kind of chronic illness, and you ran it for 3 years and you found that actually it made people's lives much better off and so on and so forth. Well, the natural thing to do would be to then extend that drug to everybody in the population, right? Mm-hmm. But that's not what's happening here at all. What's happening is saying, okay, well, this was good for these people who had this chronic illness for 3 years. Now we're going to take the drug away from them. We're going to give the drug to another 2,000 people for another 3 or 4 years. Then we're going to take the drug away from them and we're going to give it to somebody else. And that's kind of crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, why don't you think they're being more ambitious given that the results have been pretty good? Is it just a question of being scared because it feels like a kind of radical idea?
Well, I think that it has to do with money. I mean, they don't want to put the money into it. They're treating this as a support for the arts. So they see it as being part of the budget of the Department of Arts and Culture, rather than seeing it as a support for people who are in a precarious position, in which case it might be part of the budget of the Department of Social Protection. And it would be a tiny part of the budget of the Department of Social Protection, but it's a very big chunk of the budget of the Department of Culture.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that COVID was the time when the conversation around universal basic income kind of kicked off and people got very interested in the idea. It feels like these days all we talk about is the threat of AI coming for our jobs in many different industries. How is that changing the conversation around universal basic income already? And how do you think it's going to change things in the years to come?
Well, there's a huge amount of discussion about AI in the basic income movement, and people have quite different perceptions of what's going to happen. I mean, I think most of us see AI as being a big disruptor of people's jobs. And we'll find that people in a lot of different occupations, and not just in badly paid ones, are going to lose their jobs because of AI. But it's very hard to predict. Now, some people in the movement say, well, we've seen this all before, and people lose jobs in one area, but then new kinds of jobs come along. They have to retrain, of course, and adjust to those differences. And for those people, they see basic income as being a way of helping to smooth that transition, because it means that you'll have a secure income for the period when you're unemployed, during which you can study, retrain, catch your breath, and so on. Mm. Now, there are other people that have a more apocalyptic view of AI and thinks that it will put millions of people out of work for the rest of their lives. And I think that's where some of the support for basic income from some of the tech sectors has come. But I think most of us in the movement don't see a future where we've got millions of people who are only living on their basic income, and then we have other people working in the tech industry for whom money is rolling in, as being a sustainable future.
I am so intrigued to see what happens with this experiment once it continued. I mean, the early results are so promising that you would hope it just means Ireland turns into this like cultural paradise where people are making really good stuff all the time, even more than they already do, in fact. I already think that Ireland kind of punches above its weight in terms of its output. So
it's true.
Watch this space.
Our inspiration station is always packed with Irish writers and musicians. So everyone else better catch up.
Well, everybody else better fund their artists. In the show notes, I'm going to post a link to a report in which people who were part of Ireland's pilot scheme got interviewed about how having this money, this stability, how it changed their lives. Because there's some quite moving cases in there of people talking about how it's affected their mental health, how it's affected their ability to maybe think about having a family for the first time. You should check it out. And if you like hearing about interesting policy ideas, you should also check out our mini-series, Who Does It Best? Just a couple of episodes back in our feed. Three episodes that are all about looking in-depth at the cleverest, most imaginative policies in Europe, as featured in the Guardian newspaper recently.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to like them.
They did.
And I hope you will too. Inspiration Station time. What have you been enjoying lately, Dominic?
Well, last week I recommended Roselia's new album, Lux, but there is just so much new music coming out at the moment by amazing European women pop stars. So forgive me for staying on that same track, but I wanted to give a few quick shout outs to some of the new music I've been listening to over the past few weeks.
Oh, hit me.
Firstly, Sweden's coolest pop icon, Robin, has finally released some music again. Her new single, Dopamine, is her first music in 7 years, and it's a classic Robin banger. Robin's been releasing music actually since the mid-90s, and I just love that she's still going at it, and that it still feels so musically fresh.
Yeah.
I also wanted to mention a newer artist, a French artist, actually. Maybe you've heard of her. She's called OK Lou, one word.
Oh, her name is on lots of posters at the moment, but I don't know who she is because I'm too old.
Well, she's just released her debut album. It's called Choke Enough, and I'm really enjoying it. It's kind of electronic art school pop aesthetic. My sister calls her music bleep bloop music, which I think is a very accurate description, but it's fun. And finally, like so many other people, I've been really gripped by the dramatic musical storytelling of Lily Allen's latest album,
yes.
West End Girl. It almost feels to me like it's a reinvention of the 19th century German Lieder tradition of these song cycles about heartbreak from composers like Schubert and Schumann.
Has anyone else made that comparison yet? Is this a first?
I think this is a hot take, an original from me. It's really got nothing musically in common with those German romantic song cycles, but the album does really tell a story, an incredibly frank and confessional story about her marriage gradually fell apart after her husband tried to open it up. It's definitely not a great advertisement for open relationships, but it is brilliant musical storytelling from another pop veteran who's been releasing albums for 20 years. Go and check it out.
Well, we've got such a like jam-packed music recommendation week this week because I've also got an album to recommend.
Oh yeah? What is it?
Yeah, I've realised I don't actually listen to albums anymore. Isn't that terrible? Stupid algorithm.
That's a shame because there are some really great albums being made.
Yeah, and when I was a teenager, it was all that I did because we didn't have Spotify. And it's just such a different way of enjoying music. And like, as you say, you know, the storytelling of that Lily Allen album just doesn't make sense, obviously, unless you listen to the whole thing as an album. Anyway, one album that I have been listening to on repeat in recent months is an album by another French singer-songwriter, Zao de Sagazon. Do you know her?
No, I don't.
So her album is called La Symphonie des Éclairs, The Symphony of Lights, and it came out in 2023. So embarrassingly, I am a little bit behind.
Retro.
But I'm old and have two small children.
Okay, forgiven.
Anyway, I finally thought I would see what all the fuss is about because she's becoming like pretty beloved here in France. She has one of those raspy French voices that can only come from smoking 5 gazillion cigarettes a day. And I would describe her style as like somewhere between poppy and a bit more experimental and electronic, kind of on your spectrum, I would say, actually, Dominic. And she has very beautiful lyrics. They are love songs, I guess, but modern ones. I mean, she sings about toxic masculinity. She sings about abusive relationships. She sings about self-esteem. I love this album. It is one of very few these days that I just want to start playing again as soon as it ends. And if you're looking for somewhere to start, I believe the title track on this album, La Symphonie des Éclairs, I think it has 80 million plays on Spotify.
Wow.
So maybe start there. It is a song about taking risks in life, and it's very beautiful.
Well, I may as well add another female European pop star to my rotation, so I'm going to give it a try.
Go on, do it.
For my happy ending this week, I wanted to leave you with the news that it seems like France's bird population is showing signs of recovery following the ban of bee-harming pesticides.
Yay!
A study from the Fondation pour la Recherche sur la Biodiversité showed that France's insect-eating bird population seems to have grown by somewhere between 2 and 3%, 4 years after the EU banned these neonicotinoids, previously one of the most common types of insecticide used in the EU. Now, yes, 2 to 3% doesn't exactly sound like the avian equivalent of a baby boom, but considering these chemicals stick around in the soil and plants for years, any increase at all at this stage is cheering.
It's true.
And hopefully this is just the start of a much bigger comeback.
Next week, we have a pretty big deal guest on the show. Am I allowed to say who it is? I'm going to say it. It is the German climate activist, Luisa Neubauer. What can we do about the fact that climate action seems to have fallen rather far down the list of things to do internationally of late? Do not miss that conversation. And in the meantime, come and hang out with us on the internet if you fancy it. We are on Instagram, we are on YouTube, we are on Blue Sky, and we are on Mastodon.
Yeah, Mastodon, where we hardly have any followers, but we get way more interaction than anywhere else. So I think everyone should come and join us there. It's the nicest place to hang out.
It's very nice there.
It's also European made.
Mm-hmm.
This week's episode was produced by Morgan Childs with mixing and mastering by Wojciech Oleksiak. Hope everyone has a good week. See you all next Thursday.
Bye-bye.
Zbohom.